We're just coming out from Shavuos. Just to share a thought, my cousin told me just a couple of weeks ago that we say in the davening for the Yomim Tovim, Vasi'enu Hashem Elokeinu es Birkas Moadecha, bestow upon us the blessing of your festivals. And Mefarshim wonder, what is the blessing of the festivals? Is it written anywhere? To what exactly are we referring? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach used to say that the blessing of the festivals is when the Torah says, V'hayisa ach sameach. V'hayisa ach sameach, that's the blessing of the Torah. And the point is that V'hayisa ach sameach does not refer to Yom Tov. Simcha and Yom Tov is our mitzvah, that's our endeavor. The blessing of Vayisach Sameach is, if you tap into the joy of the Yom Tov, you should be happy always. That's Birkas Moadecha. Because if you're able to access the theme and the content, which is the subject of that Yom Tov, it should stay with you and be a source of joy for the rest of the year. And Rav Shlomo Zalman himself, when people would wish him a good Yom Tov or Chag Sameach, he would say Chag Sameach Vayisach Sameach. And no better way to develop even further our joy within Torah than to delve into the Parsha itself. And Parshas Balosecha, I think it's fair to say, is really packed with themes and mitzvahs and events and episodes. And let us start in the beginning with a well-known Rashi. Balosecha begins with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. Balosecha es haneros, said to Aaron the way exactly that he should light the menorah. And Rashi, as he sometimes does, gets involved in the concept of smichus parshios, the juxtaposition of sections in the Torah. Because our parsha follows on from the lengthy description of the Chanukas HaMishkan, Chanukas HaNesiim, the korbanos that the Nesiim brought. And we go from their korbanos to Aaron lighting the menorah. What has one got to do with the other? Or as my children like to ask, Ma Kesher, that classic Israeli refrain. Rashi says, Lama nismecha parshas ha-menorah la-parshas ha-nesiim. What is the menorah doing right next to the episode with the Nesiim? And he explains, because when Aaron saw the inaugural offerings of all the Nesiim, and their Nesiim of all of the tribes, conspicuously absent is the tribe of Levi. He became somewhat despondent. He was not with them in their inauguration. Not him, not his tribe. Why was he not with them? These korbanos were voluntary. But nonetheless, Aaron somehow was not involved and felt despondent. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chayecha, Hashem said to him, by your life, Shelcha gedola mishelahem, your portion will be greater than theirs. Shata madlik umetiv esaneros, because you will be lighting the lights and you will be clearing and preparing the lights. The whole enterprise of the menorah is reserved for Aaron, and that's his nechama. That's his consolation. And the question that Mefarshim ask, and first among them, is Ramban. How does the menorah itself serve specifically as a consolation for Aaron? And the background to the question is that Aaron has an ongoing involvement in any and all of the areas of avodah in the Mishkan. There's the menorah, there's the korbanos, there's the lechem apanim, there's the ketores. I mean, there's any number of things, and Aaron is involved in all of them. So in a sense, manishtana hamitzvah hazos, what would be so unique or special about the menorah that it would serve as a consolation? That is the first question. But Ramban develops the question, because he cites an additional comment of the Medrash in Hashem's words of consolation to Aaron, where Hashem said to Aaron, korbanos eina nohagim ela babayis. korbanos, they only feature and they only exist when the Beis HaMikdash is standing. Aval haneros meirim la'olam. But the lights light always. That's why the menorah is a consolation for Aaron. Everything else is restricted to the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but the light of the menorah keeps going. And Ramban asks, well, does it? The light of the menorah, like every other aspect of the Beis HaMikdash, is restricted to the time of the Mikdash. So what could the Medrash possibly mean when it says that the lights, haneros me'irim la'olam, the lights of the menorah light for always? And it's for this reason that the Ramban famously explains, unlike Rashi, that the consolation for Aaron is not the daily mitzvah in the Beis HaMikdash of lighting the menorah. Rather, it is an altogether different menorah, namely the menorah of the Chashmonaim, the Chanukah that took place specifically through the Kohanim, descendants of Aaron, at the time of Chanukah. And that indeed is an ongoing mitzvah in our time, from year to year. So this is Ramban's well-known explanation of what the Medrash is saying. And one can understand now the consolation for Aaron, because if he was upset or despondent that he was not involved in the inauguration of the Mishkan, so the consolation will come from another inauguration, the Chanukah, later on, of the story of Chanukah itself. The question is, where does this leave Rashi? After all, Rashi seems to explain that the menorah in question really is lighting the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. What about that Medrash which says, Haneros Meirim La'olam? Seemingly, the Ramban's question rings loud and clear. There is no menorah after the Beis HaMikdash, just like there's no korbanos. Rabbi Yosef Salant, the Be'er Yosef, explains that perhaps there is a difference between the menorah and other things. How so? When we talk about the korbanos, the effect of korbanos, as many Mefarshim state, is largely about to promote and enhance the physical well-being of the world. The avoda of korbanos maintains the connection between us and Hashem, allowing the world to exist in its optimum state. This, says the Netziv, is the reason why korbanos are called lechem. It's a well-known expression, bread. Es korbani lachmi. They are Hashem's bread. What could that possibly mean? Hashem doesn't need to be fed. Chas v'chalila. But rather, the korbanos are called lechem because the function of bread is to keep body and soul together. Actually, the word lechem, halchama, is fusion or bonding. And that's what happens. The body and soul are welded together through bread, representing food. And korbanos have the same effect. They keep the soul of the world, who is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, connected to the world, thereby optimizing its existence and its output. We may have mentioned this was the famous or the classic explanation of Rabbi Yeshua Heller, one of the great Litvische Gedolim, of two Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos. Right? For those who say Pirkei Avos in the post-Pesach time of year. So in the first chapter of Pirkei Avos, there are two Mishnayos which seem to discuss the same thing and give it a completely different formula. The Mishnah in the beginning of the Perek says, Al shloshad dvarim ha'olam omeid. The world stands on three things, al ha-Torah, al avoda, ve'al gemilas chasodim. Those three things, Torah, divine service, and kindness. Later on in the Perek, we seem to have almost exactly the same matter discussed. Al shloshad dvarim ha'olam kayam, that the world endures based on three things, but the three are completely different. Al hadin, al ha'emes, va'al hashalom. Judgment, truth, and peace. Now, all of these things are extremely valuable and extremely important, but they're also extremely not the same. How can we have what seems to be two different answers to the very same question? But that's why Rabbi Yeshua Heller says you need to keep an eye on the chronology. These two Mishnayos were formulated at very different times. The first was said by the famous Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik exists in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash is standing, and if you note, there's this shift in nuance in the phraseology. The first Mishnah spoke about three things on which the world is omed. The second Mishnah spoke about three things on which the world is kayam. What is the difference between omed and kayam? Omed means it stands, that is to say, it stands at its best. It is at its optimum. Kayam doesn't sound like its optimum. Kayam means it's hanging in there. It's enduring, but it's not at its best. And that's the difference between the time in which these two Mishnayos were propounded. The first is in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the world has the capacity to be omed, to stand tall, to be at its best, at its optimum. But that happens through three things. Central within them is avoda, the avoda of korbonos. That's the bread which allows for the fusion between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the world, to let the world be at its best. The Mishnah at the end of the first parak was said by a grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, a son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. This is after the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. In the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, you cannot talk about the world being omed. You have a different question. How does it endure? What keeps it going? Al shlosh advarim ha'olam kayam. You need peace, you need truth, you need judgment, but until the avoda comes back, you're in kayam mode. You want the world to be omed, you've got to have the korbanos back. And therefore, says the Be'er Yosef, the korbanos in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, they bring in physical bounty, physical blessing. But what about the menorah? The menorah brings in a blessing of insight and illumination in matters of Torah. The menorah is the symbol of Torah, as we know, kiner mitzvah, v'torah or. And as Mefarshim describe, one of the effects, if not the principal effect, of the lighting the menorah, as the flames go up, then a Torah illumination thus descends. And what is the difference, therefore, between the benefit from korbanos and the benefit of lighting the menorah? Says Be'er Yosef, the benefit of the korbanos, it exists for its time. If the world exists in its optimum state and then ceases to do so, that is of little relevance and of little help to those that come after. But if Torah insights are generated at a certain time, if Torah illumination is achieved at a certain time, that can continue to bestow blessing on later times, because based on those illuminations and based on those understandings and based on those insights, further insights can develop, and therefore future generations are yet the benefactors. Even if they don't have their own new illumination in the absence of the menorah, they yet benefit and continue to do so from the illumination that existed and was generated by the lighting of the menorah in its time. And that, says the Be'er Yosef, is why the Medrash says, even if we're talking about the menorah means the lighting of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, you can't compare korbanos to the menorah. Korbanos and the effect of korbanos is only when the Beis HaMikdash is standing. Aval haneros me'irim la'olam. The illumination that comes through the lighting of the menorah, and it's fascinating to ponder, who can know how many aspects of Torah are understood to us and are developed to us here in the 21st century, based on the lighting of the menorah that took place at any given time in the Beis HaMikdash. It continues to illuminate and continues to light. That's the very wonderful explanation of that Medrash, even according to Rashi, that the reference and the consolation for Aaron was the lighting of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. If we move a bit further in our Parsha to the beginning of Perek Tes, we come to the section which is called Pesach Sheni, and it's the first dozen or so verses in Perek Tes. And how does it begin? We talk about the order of Parshios, and Rashi has a classic comment on the first Pasuk. Perek Tes, Pasuk Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai. Hashem spoke to Moshe in the midbar Sinai. Bashana Hashenis, in the second year, Letesa Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Bachodesh Harishon Le'mor, in the first month, saying, V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moado, let the Jewish people, let b'nei Yisrael bring the Korban Pesach. What is remarkable about this section is that the Torah timestamps it as having been in the first month of the second year, that is to say, Nisan. Why is this so significant? Because if you go back to the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, which starts with the counting of the Jewish people, the Torah states that that took place in the second month, in Iyar. So chapter 1 takes place in the second month. Chapter 9 takes place in the first month, otherwise known as Ein Muktam Uma'uchar BaTorah. The Torah does not always follow the chronological sequence of events. But why did it depart from the chronological sequence, Rashi proceeds to ask? After all things being equal, follow the chronology. Why was this not mentioned first, the episode of Korban Pesach? Says Rashi, Begnusan shel Yisrael. Because this reflects negatively on the Jewish people, because it happens to be that in the 40 years that they were in the wilderness, they only brought the Korban Pesach once. And that was considered to be an indictment of the Jewish people. Why did they only bring a Korban Pesach once? Perhaps they were only told this time and fell from grace later on. Or as others say, because the Korban Pesach is only to be brought in Eretz Yisrael. This was a one-off. They were meant to be in Eretz Yisrael this time next year. So for the following 39 years that they're not there, that's the degradation of the Jewish people. There's only one one-off. Every year after that is a resounding question on the Jewish people. Why are you not where you should be to bring the Korban Pesach on location? And what is the point of Rashi, as Maharal points out? After all, sooner or later, we do get to this section. We do discover the degradation of the Jewish people. So what did we gain by moving it from the beginning of the Parsha? Well, says Maharal, because even if you have to talk about it, and you have to talk about it because there's lessons to be learnt, but there's another question. When do you talk about it? Is that the first thing you say? Is that the opening of the Sefer? Verse what? Chapter 1, verse 1, the Jewish people did something wrong. The Torah is not prepared to do that. Rather, therefore, it tucks away this episode. You have to get to it sooner or later, but better later than sooner, even though it happened earlier. That's the message, and that's a message for life. Sometimes there's things that a person needs to discuss and to communicate. They don't always have to be the first thing you say. And you can say other things, at least hello first. And that's what the Torah does. Interestingly, I believe that one may perceive this message of Rashi, that this opening section, the earlier section, was deferred on account of the fact that it speaks degradingly of the Jewish people. I think that this is communicated in the Ta'ameh HaMikra of verse 1. Ta'ameh HaMikra, the cantillation notes, which accompany, they date back to antiquity, and they accompany all of the words in the verses. The Vilna Gaon famously said, and we brought examples of this on other occasions, that these ta'amim, they're not just the way to sing the verses and the words. They also can function as a commentary to the verses. You just need to learn the language of the cantillation notes. And there is indeed a heavy concentration of traffic in verse 1. If we go through and we see Vayidaber, Hashem, El Moshe, there are three right angles underneath those words, and those right angles are called Munachs. On the word Sinai, you have what looks like a magnifying glass, which is a Talisha. The two crescents facing each other on the words Bashana Hashenis in the second year are called Kadma Va'azla. And then the final distinctive notes are on Me'eretz Mitzrayim. the Z shape and the downward with a dot, which are called Darga Tavir. If you're familiar with the names, that should all be familiar. If not, we'll just we've referenced them, but let us see how all of this relates to us. Because what have we said? We've said that this really was the earlier episode. Somehow it's been deferred. And in fact, it's been deferred. It doesn't open the Chumash, Bamidbar, not the first Parsha, not the second Parsha, not the third Parsha. It's tucked away in the middle of the third Parsha. So it's been moved. It's been uprooted from its natural location, even though it happened earlier. Why? Because it reflects badly on the Jewish people. They bought this one, but they didn't bring any more. Which means they did not maintain the level that is referred to here. Let us see how this is all expressed in the Ta'amei HaMikra. To verse 1. As we said, the first three Ta'amim are all the same. Munach, munach, munach. The word munach means set aside. And that's what's happened to this Parsha. It's been put to the side three times. Because it should have opened Parshas Bamidbar. But it's pushed aside from the beginning of Bamidbar. And again from the beginning of Nosah. And again from the beginning of Baal Osecha. It's a triple munach. It's been bumped off three times. What does that constitute? The Ta'amim on Bamidbar Sinai is called a Tlisha, as we said. And a Tlisha is an uprooting. Tolesh, to uproot. That's what's happened. To detach is litlosh. It's been detached. It's been uprooted from its natural location. Why do we say this? Because Bashana Hashenis, the two Ta'amim, are called Kadma v'Azla. Kadma means early. Azla means to go. These events went first. They happened earlier. They're Kadma v'Azla. But what are they doing here? And why are they deferred? The answer is in the final set of Ta'amim, Darga Tavir. Darga is a level, Darga. And Tavir, in Aramaic we know a shin moves to a taf. Tavir is Shavir or Shavur. Darga Tavir is a broken level. It is a level that is not maintained. And that's what happened to the Jewish people. And therefore, everything that Rashi said, the notes are saying, if you know how to read them, if you want to know why this is munach, 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 three times over, even though it's Kadma v'Azla, that's a Tlisha Gedola, that's a great uprooting. The answer is Darga Tavir, because their level was broken and was not maintained. I will say, this idea came to me actually in Parshas Baal Osecha a number of years back. I'm a Levi, so I was called for Sheni. And then after the Aliyah, so you move to the side of the Bima. And this is Shlishi. It happens to be the Balkorei in that particular shul read excruciatingly slowly. And there I was, so to speak, trapped at the Bima. And I heard him just go in blow by blow when he discusses the Jewish people or reads about the Jewish people being in the wilderness for 40 years, you really know what he's saying. That's exactly what it feels like. But it did give me opportunity to notice just how many Ta'amim are compacted into this verse. And it occurred to me that based on the Vilna Gaon, one can really see Rashi's message within the Ta'amim. So that was a blessing, I would say, although I will add that I have not gone back to that shul since then. I think quit while we're ahead is the order of the day. But either way, so once again, here we have the mitzvah to bring the first korban. What makes this section famous is that there were a group of people who were unable to bring the Korban Pesach at its time. The Pasuk says they were Temeim LeNefesh Adam. They were Tameh. They'd come into contact with the deceased. They would not be able to purify themselves in time to bring the Korban Pesach. And they came to Moshe, amazingly, and complained. And said, Lama Nigara? Why should we miss out? Which itself is just an incredible idea. As far as we know, if you miss the time for the mitzvah, you miss it. We've never heard of anyone missing anything else and saying, why should we miss out? We should get a second chance. And more amazing is they got a second chance. And this then becomes this, the special mitzvah called Pesach Sheni, a month later, the 14th of Iyar, just a couple of weeks ago we had it, which is the second opportunity to bring the Korban Pesach. And therefore, what makes this section distinctive, the news here is Pesach Sheni, which is described in these psukim. But what's interesting is, Mefarshim make sure that we don't miss the details here. It all started by the fact that they were commanded to bring Pesach Rishon. But why were they commanded to bring Pesach Rishon? Were they not told to bring the first time round on Pesach itself? This whole thing never would have started. But why did they need a special commandment to bring the Korban Pesach? After all, the first Pesach is a mitzvah like any other mitzvahs. We don't find that they get ongoing reminders to keep all of the seasonal mitzvahs. Why did they get a reminder to bring the Korban Pesach? Well, actually, at its most basic level, the answer to this question relates to a matter that we raised before. Namely, is the Korban Pesach something that would naturally be brought outside the land of Israel? Where does this discussion come from? In Parshas Bo, that is Shmos Perek Yud Beis, which is where the Jewish people are actually told for the first time about Korban Pesach, there is a pasuk which says, V'haya ki tavo el ha'aretz, when you come to the land of Israel and you bring the Korban Pesach, the follow-on is the famous question your children will say, Ma ha'avoda hazos lachem. It's famous as the question of the Ben Rasha. But either way, you see that within that chapter of our very first introduction to Korban Pesach, it's described as when you come to the land of Israel and you bring the Korban Pesach. And now the question is, what does the pasuk mean to say? Does it mean that, in principle, Korban Pesach is only to be offered in the land of Israel? Or perhaps does it mean something else? Either way, Mefarshim explain, we can understand why the Jewish people needed to be told in year two, that is to say, a year after leaving Mitzrayim, to bring the Korban Pesach. Because if you take the view that it is tied to the land of Israel, then this is a one-off. They would not have thought to bring the Korban Pesach until they get to the land of Israel. So they needed to be told, even though you're off location, bring the Korban Pesach. If we say, or we take the other view, that the Korban Pesach can actually be offered even outside the land of Israel, maybe that is itself is what they were being informed here. They should not misconstrue that it is only to be brought in the land of Israel, rather wherever they are, including here. Those explanations to why they needed to be told to bring the first Pesach, on Pesach itself, in the wilderness, come from Rishonim. But once again, Rabbi Yosef Salant de Be'er Yosef has a fascinating suggestion as to why they needed to be told. And he himself engages a little bit in Smichus Parshios, paying attention to the juxtaposition of the sections in the Parsha. This is the beginning of chapter 8. And what precedes it? A discussion of the appointment of the Leviim. That's very interesting, right? For the second half of chapter 8, it's all about the appointment of the Leviim. Why is that significant for us? The Leviim, as we discussed last week or 2 weeks ago, took the place of the firstborn. Until that time, the avoda belonged to the firstborn. But when they soured at the time of the eagle, the golden calf, it was transferred to the Leviim. So what is Korban Pesach? Korban Pesach is the Korban that we bring because HaKadosh Baruch Hu skipped over and spared the firstborn of Yisrael when he smote the firstborn of the Egyptians, thereby sanctifying the firstborn of Yisrael. That's where Kedushas Bechor comes from, the sanctity of the Bechor. So the totality, seemingly, or the essence at least, of the Korban Pesach, of the Pesach offering, is to celebrate significantly the sanctification of the firstborn. Look what happened to them. They then assumed the avoda, they brought the korbanos. But then look what happened to them. They lost it. At the time of the Chet HaEgel, they got replaced. And therefore, says Ber Yosef, one may have thought that perhaps No one's going to say, don't keep Pesach. I mean, Pesach is the festival of the liberation and the birth of the Jewish people. No one's going to say not to keep Pesach. But maybe the Korban Pesach isn't the same. And maybe it's not even there at all. Because what Pesach celebrates is the sanctification of the Bechorim. But then they abdicated on it. They forfeited it. And maybe when they lost their special status, maybe the Korban Pesach loses its special commemorative capacity. Maybe it's not the same, and maybe it's not there at all. And that's the Smichus Parshas. As if to say, the Torah is saying, Bechorim fell from grace, but Korban Pesach is still in place. V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moadu. So these are very interesting explanations of the question that can easily go unasked. Because it's very easy to gravitate immediately towards Pesach Sheni and never ask, well, why were we discussing Pesach Rishon in the first place? I mean, that should have been self-understood. It shouldn't have been a discussion. But let us now turn our attention to these individuals. And they are discussed in Perek Tes, Pasuk Vav. Vayhi anashim asher hayu tmeim lenefesh adam. You have these people, they were Tomei because they came into contact with the deceased, and they came to Moshe and they said, it's not fair, we demand a second chance, why should we lose that? The Gemara in Maseches Sukkah, in the second chapter, Daf Kaf Vav, is very interested to know who these people were. The Torah doesn't identify them. There were people who were Tamei LeNefesh Adam. And the Torah, but the Gemara wants to know, who were they? How did they come to be Tamei LeNefesh Adam? How did they come to have contract the impurity that comes through contact with the deceased? And the premise or the background to the Gemara's question is that we're not aware that any one of the Jewish people died during that time. So how can they be Tamei LeNefesh Adam? And to this, the Gemara answers with no less than three opinions. The first opinion, Rabbi Yishmael says, who are these people in contact with the deceased? They were those who bore the coffin of Yosef, who carried the coffin of Yosef wherever they went. And that's why they were Tamei Meis, because they've been in contact with Yosef. We mentioned this again a couple of months ago when we spoke about tzaddikim, the concept of whether righteous impart Tumas Meis, the tumor that goes with the deceased. Apparently Yosef did, and Yosef is called Yosef HaTzaddik. So that is support, certainly, for those who understand that even tzaddikim impart tumas meis. But either way, that is the first explanation. Rabbi Akiva then offers his opinion, and that is, Rabbi Akiva says that there were two people that we know who died in this time, famously, Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, and they were carried out by their cousins, Mishael and Elzaphan, as described in Parsha Shmini. And Rabbi Akiva is of the understanding that it was Mishael and Elzaphan. That's how they came to be Tomei Meis, through coming into contact with their cousins, Nadav and Avihu, and they were the ones who asked. Whereas the third opinion, rather I would say generically, or that is Rabbi Yitzchak, says that there was a meis mitzvah, there was someone who had no relatives, as Mefarshim add, probably someone from the Erev Rav, who died, no one could take care of them, so some people took care of him, and they were the ones. Very non-specific. That's the third opinion, meis mitzvah. So again, to have these opinions, these suggestions clearly in front of us. Rabbi Yishmael, the first opinion is they were the ones who carried Yosef. Rabbi Akiva, the second opinion says it was Mishael and Elzaphan, who took care of Nadav and Avihu. And the third opinion, Rabbi Yitzchak says, they were people who just took care of a meis mitzvah. We don't know who this meis mitzvah was, and we don't know. What are the implications of these three opinions? There is actually potentially an implication where we might not have expected it. And let us see how. The Mishkan began on what is known as Yom HaShmini, on the eighth day. And the question is, when is the eighth day? The eighth day of what? Rashi, famously citing the Medrash, says that this eighth day is actually, it's Rosh Chodesh. It's Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It's called the eighth day because it follows the seven preparatory days, the last 7 days of Adar. But as a date, it's Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And his source is the Medrash, and I think that's quite well known. Rashi says this more than once in his commentary to the Torah. So if you want to know when the Yom HaShmini is, and you want to give Rashi's answer from Chazal in the Medrash, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. However, the Ibn Ezra, and as we know, the Ibn Ezra is well capable of offering interpretations which are not Rashi's and differ from Rashi. Ibn Ezra has reason to suggest and to maintain that the Yom HaShmini, which was the opening day of the Mishkan, was actually the 8th of Nisan. In his understanding, the seven preparatory days were not the last 7 days of Adar. They're the first 7 days of Nisan. And the Yom HaShmini is the 8th of Nisan. It's not because it's called the Yom HaShmini. He has other reasons to demonstrate that, in fact, the Yom HaShmini is the 8th of Nisan. So if we would summarize, the Ibn Ezra differs by a week his whole understanding of the proceedings. So what do we have before us? We have what seems to be another one of those cases where Rashi seems to be sourced in Chazal, in the Medrash, and the Ibn Ezra goes it alone. He explains the psukim based on the psukim, and even if it's not like Rashi or not like the Medrash, Ibn Ezra he feels comfortable explaining the way he feels the psukim should be explained. It happens. With Ibn Ezra, it can happen, and as with others. But perhaps there's a little bit more to it. Let's go back to these three opinions and see what's at stake here. Who were these three men? Who were these men who were Tomei LeNefesh Adam? Because the Gemara actually explains why the third opinion takes issue with the first two. How long does it take in order for a person to recover, so to speak, from impurity, tumas meis? 7 days, as we know. The question is, you must be dealing with people that didn't have time to recover. And that's why Rabbi Yitzchak says, I do not agree with the first opinion, that it's those who carried Yosef's aron, because they haven't come in contact with Yosef's coffin for months now. So that they should have had ample time. They just need 7 days. They've had much more than 7 days. And he levels exactly the same criticism on the second opinion, on Rabbi Akiva's. Because if it's Mishael and El Tzofan, who became Tomei due to Nadav and Avihu, but they also had more than 7 days, because that took place on the 1st of Nisan, and Pesach is on the 14th of Nisan, so you have 2 weeks to get ready, and you only need 1 week. And that is why Rabbi Yitzchak, the third opinion, feels that he has no choice but to take recourse to a more general sounding answer, that it was a mace mitzvah and it was on the 8th of Nisan, and that's why they didn't have time. Because everyone else can be time stamped earlier, giving you enough time to recover. That's why Rabbi Yitzchak, the third opinion, doesn't accept the first two. However, says the Malbim, if you look at Rabbi Akiva, maybe there's a little bit more to it than meets the eye. Because Rabbi Akiva, surely, he is the second opinion. Mishael and El Tzofan, presumably he offered his opinion because he shared the same concern. If it's those who carried Yosef, so they haven't come into contact with him for months, all it takes is a week, and that's why he offers his interpretation. But then he himself seems to suffer from the very same question, because his episode was 2 weeks before Pesach. And it just takes a week to recover. Unless, says the Malbim, Rabbi Akiva actually is in concurrence with Ibn Ezra. That the Yom HaShmini, the opening day of the Mishkan, was on the 8th of Nisan. Because that's when Nadav and Avihu died. And if that's when it happened, and that's when Mishael and El Tzofan became Tomei, their day 7 is the 14th of Nisan. That's the day of the bringing of the Korban Pesach. And they're still Tomei. And therefore, says Malbim, if you know how to read between the concerns that generated these different suggestions as to who these people were, it emerges that even though the Ibn Ezra is capable of offering an opinion, even if there is no source in Chazal, and the source in Chazal says otherwise when it comes to Parshanut, in this instance, the good news is he doesn't have to. It's a machlokas in Chazal. Both opinions are sourced in Chazal. Rabbi Akiva, who says that those who didn't have time, they didn't have 7 days to get Tahor before Pesach, because the inaugural day of the Mishkan was the 8th of Nisan, that let them still tome on Pesach. That's the source for the Ibn Ezra. So very interesting association from Chazal to the Rishonim. It's very interesting to note, just as a PS, and to close a circle a little bit. We raised the question a few moments ago, why does Hashem need to tell the Jewish people that they should bring the Korban Pesach? That much seemingly is obvious. And we gave the answers that are given. Perhaps it's only in Israel, so they need to be told, and so on and so forth. But the Sfarno has a different explanation as to why they needed to be informed that Korban Pesach is on. Why? Because the Sfarno agrees with Ibn Ezra. And parenthetically, may we add, with Rabbi Akiva, in his understanding of the timeline of events, that the first inaugural day was the 8th of Nisan. Why is that so significant? Because the inauguration of the Mishkan took place over the first 12 days. So, elsewhere in Tanakh, we will discover that when the Beis HaMikdash was dedicated by Shlomo, and Shlomo himself then had 2 weeks of inaugural festivities, that Chanukah of the Beis HaMikdash, it overrode everything in its way. The Gemara says in Maseches Moed Katan that the timing of Shlomo's Chanukah of the Beis HaMikdash, of the first Beis HaMikdash, was during Tishrei. And there were festivities for 2 weeks. And on that year, they did not fast on Yom Kippur, because it was overridden as what's called the Horaat Sha'ah. Chanukas HaMishkan mows down anything in its way. Well, says the Sfarno, if the Chanukas HaMishkan, with us, those first 12 days, and if they started on the 8th of Nisan, they would run into Pesach. One may have thought that the Korban Pesach was suspended for that year, in the same way that Yom Kippur ultimately was suspended in the year that Shlomo made his Chanukah of the Beis HaMikdash. One may have thought that Korban Pesach would be an interference of sorts within the 12 inaugural days, the Chanukahs of the Mishkan, and that is why they need to be told. Korban Pesach is still on, even though it will take place during the 12 inaugural days of the Mishkan. So we see how these themes continue to come back and give further insight and understanding in these psukim. Let us move now to, again, another of the, I would say, the mitzvahs of the Parsha, and that is the mitzvah of Chatzotzros, of the trumpets. And again, there's a dozen or so psukim dealing with it, and they are the first 10 psukim of Perek Yud, of chapter 10. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'mor, Asel, Hashem says to Moshe, Asel lecha shtei chatzotzos kesef, you shall make two trumpets, and these trumpets have various functions. They're to tell the people when to move, when to stop. They're for times of war, they're for times of celebration, each time with different sounds, denoting which one. But this is the special mitzvah of Chatzotzros. Interestingly, the Gemara states, and Rashi quotes, that in verse 2, when Hashem says to Moshe, Asei lecha, make for yourself, shtei chatzotzros kesef, Rashi explains, no one else can use these, only you. And the Gemara explicates even further, they were buried together with Moshe. And this is very interesting, Because in principle, the mitzvah of chatzotzos, I mean, we don't have it nowadays because those things we don't really encounter, but the mitzvah of chatzotzos, in principle, is applicable in all generations. When there's the Beis HaMikdash, and on Yom Tov, for example, we'll get to the final verse, Uv'yom Simchatchem, Uv'moadechem, Utekatem b'chatzotzos, when it's going to be a Yom Tov, blow the trumpet. So there is it's a mitzvah ledoros. It's a mitzvah for all generations, in principle. So if that's true, so why can no one else use the trumpets of Moshe? Is it, so to speak, simply because he's Moshe and maybe he's like the king and one's not allowed to avail himself of it? We don't find this with other things. And this question was addressed by Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, Dain Abramsky, Zatzal. And the reason why he discussed it is because people queried a certain writing style of his. Namely, Rav Abramsky, in addition to his classic work on the Tosefta, which is a classic rabbinic scholarship work, monumental commentary on the Tosefta, but he also wrote many, in Hebrew, many articles, and even Sfarim. He has a Sefer on Eretz Yisrael, a wonderful Sefer, Eretz Yisrael, Nachalas Am Yisrael. And the style that he adopted when he wrote these in these periodicals and these other types of Sfarim was a much more a literary style, which was more in the way that the literary types or elite almost were writing. And he adopted that style in order to express the Torah ideas that he wanted to express. And people asked him about it, perhaps even criticized him for it. After all, that's not the traditional way that rabbis express themselves. And an explanation as to why he did this, he pointed to our pasuk. The pasuk says that the trumpets that Moshe used to rally the people, to tell them when to move, when to stop, when they're in trouble, when they're everything's okay, and so on and so forth, to get the message across, those trumpets were buried with Moshe. But what does that tell us? Other people will also need trumpets. They need to make their own, because not every generation is the same as Moshe Rabbeinu's. And therefore, as much as the message needs to be the authentic message communicated, but the vessel that communicates it can change from generation to generation. And that is how he explained that the times gone by, before you had whatever you'll call them, the maskilim and so on and so forth, there was a certain style. We need new trumpets in order to get the sound of the Torah across. And that's a very interesting idea, of course, to ponder exactly what are its implications and applications. There is a very famous concept of dor v'dorshav, each generation and its expounders, dor v'dorshav. Rav Abramsky is telling us there's another concept, dor v'chatzotzrav, each generation and its trumpets, the vessels that are used, the vehicles that are used, the mediums that are used in order to get the message of the Torah across. And what are, as we said, what are the occasions when this is, the ensuing psukim outline? When the people need to travel, when the people need to encamp, at a time of war, v'chitavo milchama, varios and b'chatzotzros. And then the final pasuk, yud, perik yud, pasuk yud, uv'yom simchatchem, uv'moadechem, uv'roshecha tshechem. On the day of your joy, on your festivals, on Rosh Chodesh, utekatem b'chatzotzros, you shall blow the trumpets, al aloseichem val sivchei shalmeichem, on the various korbanos that are brought. Okay, so what are the three occasions mentioned in this pasuk? Number one, b'yom simchaschem, the time of your joy. Number two, moadechem, your festivals. Number three, Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh. And the question that everyone wants to know is, what is Yom Simchaschem, the day of your joy? I think if the pasuk hadn't gone on to specify the festivals, we would have said the festivals. V'samachta b'chagecha, they're times of simcha. But once the pasuk is outlined in the next phrase, Moadechem, your festivals, so go back to Yom Simchaschem. It can't be the festivals, they're already accounted for. What then is Yom Simchaschem? So here, the Netziv and the Meshech Chochma both intuit the same path, each one availing themselves of their mastery of Tanakh and Chazal, and they both come to the same conclusion. What is Yom Simchaschem that the Pasuk is referring to? If there's, whenever there is a Chanukah, like a Chanukah Samikdash, Chanukah Samishkan, whenever there's an inauguration, there is a special mitzvah to sound the Chatzotzros. Why do they call those times Yom Simchaschem? Actually, says the Netziv, the source is in the Mishnah, in the end of Maseches Tanis, which discusses the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which refers to two dates, Yom Chatunato, V'yom Simchat Dibo. It's right, Se'enu Re'ena, Ba'itra, She'itra, Melech, Shlomo, V'yom Chatunato, on the day of his wedding, V'yom Simchat Dibo, on the day of his joy. And the Mishnah provides events for those two. When is the day of Hashem's wedding? It's Matan Torah. Very apropos for Shavuos. Indeed, as Mefarshim point out, Poskim more correctly point out, many of the customs that we have that accompany a wedding come directly from Har Sinai. The custom that the Chassid and Kala are led with torches, says the Tashbatz, is a zecher for the fire that was there at Har Sinai, and so on and so forth. So Yom Chatunato, which is really the wedding, so to speak, between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is the time of Matan Torah. That's Yom Chatunato. But what about Yom Simchat Libo, the day of his joy, the joy of his heart? Says the Mishnah, Ze Chanukas HaMikdash. That is the inauguration of the Mikdash. That's called the time of Hashem's joy as he comes to reside with the Jewish people. And therefore, says the Netziv, once we see Chazal have explained that Yom Simchas Libo is a time of Chanukas HaMikdash, when the Beis HaMikdash is built and begins, so we can, our way is clear to explain that that's the first phrase in Pasuk Yud. Uv'yom Simchaschem is a time of Chanukah. And as we said, the Netziv and Meshech Chochmah then proceed to sweep through Nach, showing and highlighting how in all the significant Chanukah events, and when we say Chanukah, we mean the inauguration or dedication or rededication of the Beis HaMikdash in the time of Shlomo HaMelech and in the time of Ezra and in all the in-between times when things were reset and rededicated, you'll find there were always a reference in the Pasuk to the Kohanim blowing the Chatzotzros. And it would be easier, even if we got to those, it's in Divrei HaYomim and so on and so forth, just to read it and say, okay, trumpets, very nice, but it's not just very nice. That is the fulfillment of Uv'yom Simchaschem Utakatem Bechatzotzros. That is the explanation of Netziv and Meshech Chochmah. Yom Simchaschem are the Chanukos. Having said that, and they're well aware of this, of course, we need to reckon with the fact that Chazal themselves have given an explanation of what is Yom Simchaschem. The Sifrei, which is the Medrash Halacha to Bamidbar Devarim, the Sifrei on our Pasuk says, Uv'yom Simchaschem Eilu HaShabbosos. That's Shabbos. And this is a very interesting discovery, I think, for us. That Shabbos is a day of Simcha. It's called Yom Simchaschem. I'm not saying we should be surprised if a person is happy on Shabbos, but that it has the designation of Yom Simcha. Why? Because Simcha, in that way, we typically apply more to Yom Tov. Because the Torah says, V'samachta b'chagecha, and we talk about Simcha v'sason on Yom Tov. The concepts that we associate with Shabbos are not so much Simcha, normally. They're more Onik, the Karasala Shabbos Onik, or Kovod Shabbos. but not so much Simcha Shabbos. And yet, here is the Sifrei, that Shabbos is also called Yom Simchatchem. And the question that we may ask is why? As basic a question as it sounds. And the background to the question is, if it's a Yom Tov, that's a special time that Hashem did something for us, or whatever it will be, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, each one in its time. Those are days of Simcha, we understand. Shabbos is extremely important. It's foundational. But why is it a day of Simcha? Where does the Simcha of Shabbos come from? That's an interesting shaila. There's nothing more important than recognizing Hashem as creator of the world. But important doesn't always equal day of joy. It's important to mourn the Beis HaMikdash. That doesn't make it a day of joy. The fact that something's important. But Mefarshim explain. We say that Shabbos is also, we call it Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. In Kiddush we say, Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. And the simple question is, why? If you tell me that it's Zecher L'Maaseh Bereishis, so then it is. Shabbos is the seventh day. It reminds, commemorates Maaseh Bereishis. How is it Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim? Shabbos pre-existed Yetzias Mitzrayim. What's one thing got to do with the other? But Mefarshim explain that even though Shabbos commemorates the creation of the world, it's given specifically to the Jewish people. Would it not have been intuitive that a day that commemorates the creation of the world should be given to all creations in the world? But we know that that's not so, and the Pasuk emphasizes, Beini uvein b'nei Yisrael osi le'olam. And that means that the special quality of Shabbos has been entrusted from Hashem only for the Jewish people, because they are His people. And that's where the joy of Shabbos comes from. That's where we say in Kiddush, we say it's Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, and go on to say, Kivona v'charta v'sana kidashtimi kol ha'amim, because you chose us. That is why Shabbos is Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, because what it commemorates is the creation of the world. But when we're mindful of the fact that we're the only ones entrusted with this day, it's Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. But that shows our special connection with Hashem, and that's where the joy comes from. And that is why, says the Shibboleth HaLeket, if you wish to know, is there any reference in our prayers to the concept that Shabbos is a day of joy? There is in Musaf of Shabbos. If you daven Nusach Sfarad, you get there even earlier. But in Nusach Ashkenaz, when it comes to Musaf, Yismechu b'malchuscha shomri Shabbos v'kori oni. Those that enjoy Shabbos will delight in your kingship. That is, says the Shibboleth HaLeket, where does that concept come from in our Shabbos prayers? From this Sifrei, Uv'yom Simchaschem, Eilu HaShabbosos. But it's honing for us and defining for us, why is Shabbos a day of Simcha? Because Yismechu B'malchuscha, those that enjoy the Shabbos and access the Shabbos and partake of it, are delighting in the fact that it's something given from Hashem to them, because He is their King and they are His people, and that's where the Simcha of Shabbos comes from. So we're a long way away from the traditional sections in the Torah of Shabbos, but we've discovered through the lens of the Sifrei and then through the Siddur exactly where the source of the joy of Shabbos comes from. Certainly food for thought for the Shabbos is to come. I wish you all the very best. Have a good evening and a wonderful week ahead.